Well, I think having more housing than we need is preposterous. I keep hearing the word federal come up. When New Orleans happened, a lot of people got displaced, unfortunately, to different states. We're talking federal. Now, we're about to dish out billions of dollars on Hurricane Sandy. We're saying we have housing that we don't need. If it's me you don't care about and don't want to see me pop up in certain neighborhoods, that's fine. You still got Staten Island. They didn't even go to the Rockaways because they want that little press thing. So they flew over Rockaway. I don't know if they could drop a bomb or food packages. Staten Island, you got the beach. You got all kinds of areas. People have no houses. Can't you work together, federal government, and cut the cost of the money that we're about to dish out, which we don't have, and get some people some houses? They're not crazy. A lot of people want to relocate. Some don't. Some may do it because they have to and find out it was the best thing for them. I mean, having more housing than we need, I mean, that's ridiculous.
Okay. So I'm very well aware of what Sandy did to the housing stock around here. The pictures have been heartbreaking. I grew up in northern New Jersey, cut school from time to time to go to Seaside Heights. And so those pictures ring true to me and bring home the calamity that you guys have suffered up here. So I was speaking at the broad macroeconomic level, just at the level of the entire country. Absolutely for sure. Katrina was a disaster, a shock to the housing stock there, and this is a negative shock to the housing stock here.
Let's let President Lackey respond.
Thanks. I definitely appreciate that, and I think there's a role for emergency assistance in those kinds of situations that's quite appropriate. The extent to which that assistance, I mean, that assistance sort of doesn't really depend on mortgage rates. That's assistance, something that is part of our apparatus as a country that channels emergency relief funds to needed areas, and I'm totally supportive of that. I'm talking about at the macroeconomic level of the entire country. You know, broadly speaking, housing prices, you know, have risen a little bit, but we still have an overhang of inventory in a lot of areas. It may not be the areas people need houses. It may not be the kind of houses people want. It may be the case that people don't want that owner-occupied housing isn't the most appropriate form of the housing stock. I think that's a lot of the transition we're going through because home ownership has now been revealed to people as riskier than we thought it was. It used to be viewed as a more or less a one-way bet, and I think people now realize that highly leveraged home ownership has some downside risks for people, and I think that's what's behind the decline in the home ownership rate and the broad shift to rental over owner-occupied housing. So this isn't to deny that there aren't significant pockets of problems in housing markets.
Yes, Murray.
You talked about the exit strategy and paying higher interest on excess reserves. Is there any sense of how high those interest rates might have to go?
Yes.
I didn't hear the answer.
Yes.
Can you comment on that?
No.
Okay. Would we be frightened if you did?
I think people should prepare for a wide range of contingencies.
Jeff, I have a question. Okay, so the Fed announced QE3, which involves expanding the Fed's balance sheet quite a bit, yet the Fed's official long-range inflation forecast is unchanged. So with each succeeding Fed easing and bloating of the balance sheet, it seems not to affect the Fed's forecasts of inflation. So I'd like you to comment on that, but I'd also like you to comment as a dissenter. For those on the committee who are concerned that inflation rise, how within the committee, how when you express your concerns, what's the reaction around the table? And is this getting to the issue of the Fed's perspective on inflation? I would note that with the high unemployment rate, the Fed's models actually predicted deflation when it hasn't happened. So how does the Fed really think about inflation, and does it really honestly believe that inflation is not going to rise at all, even with additional, you know, monetary stimulus?
That's a good question, Mickey. You speak about the Fed's view, and you know, as you well know, the FOMC is a collection of individuals who bring their best independent assessment to bear on the problems at hand. These people come with different perspectives, with different readings of the data, with different readings of the theory. My dissent was, I don't think, a surprise, because we've been in a dialogue in the meetings for years now about inflation dynamics, about monetary policy and its effect on labor markets and inflation. And I think people have a good sense of other people's, the range of different perspectives. Those perspectives evolve over time. New events are interpreted in light of different perspectives. But I think the strength of the committee has been that there are these independent views that are brought to bear. And you have a committee that, you know, as a matter of governance, doesn't have the doesn't push the committee as strongly towards homogeneity as some other governance structures might. So I think that's the strength of the committee. So to the substance of the question about inflation dynamics, this is within the profession a longstanding tension between views that that highlight and you know, view as strong the effect of monetary policy on real outcomes, on growth and employment, and you know, a vision that those effects are transitory. They're attributable to the temporary frictions that prevent the firms that prevent them from temporarily from adjusting their prices immediately to changes in monetary conditions. So there's a lag in that adjustment, and in the meantime, you have some effects on real sales, real output, real employment, but those fade over time. So you have these different models. You have, you know, you have them all resting within a coherent framework, though, I think, that has coalesced amazingly over the last 50 years to, I think, narrow the range of views to you know, a fairly definable set. But within that set of views, there's, you know, there are reasonable differences of opinion about how to interpret the data and how interpret, you know, what the theory is, you know, when you take it to the data, is really telling us. You know, I tend to, in current circumstances, my, you know, I've said this many times before, I think that, you know, the economy was hit by a real shock, not a monetary shock. I think it was, you know, we can talk about what caused the housing boom, but let's take the housing boom as given. The collapse in residential construction threw millions of residential construction workers on the market. Consistent with past recessions, that shifted the skill composition of the pool of unemployed workers adversely relative to what employers wanted in the new hires they were contemplating. That implies some adjustments that are costly and time-consuming, and it takes time to train people for the jobs that are available now. We've seen this. We've gone to North Carolina and elsewhere in the Fifth Federal Reserve District and seen community college programs that are designed to, you know, they build these custom training programs for firms that give the kids a 12-week program, or actually grown adults, older workers sometimes come back to community colleges, go through these programs designed to train machinists or welders or people to use computer controlled machinery on a factory floor. That takes time to work through. I'm not saying that's the only impediment to growth, but that's there in the labor markets that makes it a slow process. And I think that's consistent with the historical pattern over time of a gradual decline in the unemployment rate, the problem really being that the rate of exit from the unemployment pool of unemployed is lower than it is in good economic times. There are other impediments to growth that seem to reflect rational choice, sort of rational adaptation to current circumstances. I'd mentioned consumer household confidence. Consumers seem awfully cautious now. They've raised their savings rate. Their growth in their spending is about in line with the growth in their real disposable income. So they're not taking on new debt. They're tending to add to their savings. They're tending to pay down the debt they have. I think that American households have been, hunkered down significantly. I think that they, going into the recession, would have looked back at a two and a half decade span of pretty mild recessions and thought maybe the downside risks are kind of small. And they've come out of this recession with a renewed appreciation of downside macroeconomic risks in the labor market. And I think are cautious, are rationally, I think, cautious as a result. I don't believe a recession like the one we've been through is likely. But you can understand why consumers would react with some caution. And that's a rational response. And so do we want to push consumers off the path of adjustment to what they're doing by trying to stimulate their spending? To some extent, maybe, but there's limits to I think how much we ought to be wanting to do that. And then on top of that, we've been hearing for 2 years about businesses, medium and small-sized businesses, and their profound uncertainty about aspects of federal policy that affect the profitability of new ventures they might be considering. And it runs the gamut from regulatory policy at the EPA or the Department of Labor or the like, to tax policy. They know this fiscal cliff's coming. They know some grand bargain may be coming. They know some change in their tax rates coming, but they don't know what it is. To healthcare, we had people at a director's meeting a month or two ago, advisory council meeting, saying, I asked my insurance broker, what's the Affordable Care Act going to cost me? What's it going to mean for my insurance costs? And the broker said, I don't know. And a bunch of people chimed up and said, well, we're hearing the same thing as well. So they're saying, well, I'm sitting on the sidelines until I have a better sense of where policy is going, till I'm able to make the calculations and know, the policy parameters to put in to know whether on an after-tax basis it's profitable or not. And they say, and these are nonpartisan comments. I mean, they say, we don't care which way you go, just choose. Give us the rules of the game so we know where we're headed. And, we'll get off the sidelines and make a decision, either build here or build overseas or do what we're going to do. So I think I look at those impediments and I ask, are further declines in long-term yields likely to move us towards a better growth path? And it doesn't seem that plausible to me. Now, I'll admit that this is a judgmental assessment and not based on, a formal quantitative analysis. But I think in doing policy in real time, you're stuck having to rely on a judgmental comparison of various model analyses that are imperfect in their own ways with anecdotal evidence, and reports from what people are thinking, and comparison about what those people are saying they're thinking to what people in your model would say if you asked them, and the data we see, and that judgment has led me to sort of the vision, the assessment that, you know, it monetary policy is not likely to be able to raise growth rates very significantly now. And if they did, I doubt they could do it without raising inflation. That's just my fundamental assessment right now of growth.
Yes.
I'm Mary O'Grady of the Wall Street Journal. You mentioned the importance of humility at the central bank. And in the previous answer you gave, you talked about the mismatches in our education system. And, you know, I guess the Fed is talking about education in part because of the dual mandate, that because you have to provide this, you know, attempt at doing something about the unemployment rate, you're doing lots of other things that, you know, some people would suggest don't show any humility. I mean, you're sort of into all kinds of things. And I'm just wondering, I mean, isn't the whole idea of targeting unemployment, doesn't that attract a kind of lack of humility at the Fed? Because doesn't that sort of make you behave like you can fix a problem that you really can't fix, and you start getting... I mean, I think that Coach Lakota has actually written about this, talking about how, you know, you really can't at this point influence the unemployment rate because these are structural problems. I mean, I realize that you're not in charge of the dual mandate, but it seems like there's a contradiction there. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Mary. We have this mandate, and Congress passed this in 1977, and it lists three things. It lists inflation, maximum employment, and moderate long-term interest rates. So we really have these sort of three mandates. Over the time that evolved to a dual mandate, I think the phrase was invented sometime in the early 1990s. We, as a policymaker, you take that and you take your sense of how the economy works, and you try and do as well as you can for the American public, the way you construe that. But you have to take into account, you know, the uncertainty you face about how the economy really moves. If you look at that January statement, it's very clear that inflation is under the control of the central bank. You know, it's hard to get it exactly right. It's hard to stamp out volatility in inflation. It's hard to keep it from fluctuating around from quarter to quarter. But ultimately, there's just very little argument about the notion that it's fundamentally the responsibility of the central bank and the central bank, virtually the central bank alone. There's some theoretical qualifications to that having to do with fiscal policy, but set those aside for a second. You know, it's fundamentally a central bank's job and the central bank's ability to control inflation over the long run. So the statement's also cast a different – the tone shifts in the next paragraph where it talks about employment and the maximum employment part. It talks about how employment and what the economy is capable of achieving by way of employment is – determined by a host of other factors in the economy, demographics, productivity, and tax policy, fiscal policy, and the like, and that those are beyond the control of monetary policy. So it says that, and it lays out that there are these other determinants, and it says that as a result, it's inappropriate for us to set a numerical objective for the unemployment rate or something in. Something having to do with the maximum employment part of our mandate, that it would be inappropriate to set an explicit unemployment target. So that paragraph, I think, gets that tone right, that there's this difference in how you think about these things. And it serves the public well for us to treat them a bit differently, I think. Now, in very simple models, you know, you write down a couple of variables, you got a couple of equations, the things you use for sort of illustrating things in the classroom, three equation models, there's a standard workhorse, the three equation model that I have in mind. In those, our understanding of our effect on those is symmetric. So if we can have an influence on it's that asymmetry in our knowledge about how we can affect them and the knowledge of where unemployment is going, that's gone. That's off the table in those models. It's just swept aside. And to me, an element of humility ought to be, you know, be careful about the risk of taking some models too seriously. You know, there's a lot of assumptions in those little classroom models for convenience that make it just simple algebraically. Well, you know, they're freighted with implications, and I think it's easy to sort of take the jump from those simple models and go too far with them. You know, I think economies are complicated things, and it's, you know, we're still getting a bead on what happened a year or two ago. It's still not clear what's going on with this regular acceleration of growth every winter. You know, are there seasonal adjustment problems we're wrestling with? I mean, I think avoiding overpromising is important for a central bank to do for their own credibility.
On that note, I want to thank President Lacker for your very thoughtful speech and your very thoughtful and provocative answers. So thank you very much.